Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, lower insurance rates sound great, but do they come with a catch? We've got new reporting on big tech's involvement in New York. We'll unpack who's pushing Governor Hochul's plan and why. From the streets of Minneapolis to a small town school board in New York, Americans are grappling with the role of federal agents in local life. Plus, Holly is rethinking how public space can drive economic growth. We'll learn more about their Outdoor Towns initiative. Pennsylvania's plan to expand broadcast access is approved, except it isn't. Why federal officials missed their own deadline. And think disco is just a nighttime thing? Think again. Daytime disco is coming to the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. We'll learn more after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. The Trump administration is moving the top Border Patrol officer out of Minneapolis and out of his leadership role. Greg Bovino has been the face of the Trump administration's immigration efforts. President Trump is sending Border Czar Tom Homan to Minneapolis instead. This comes as furor grows over the Trump administration's immigration crackdown in Minnesota. A federal judge in Minnesota has ordered Acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Todd Lyons to show up personally in a Minneapolis courtroom on Friday. From Minnesota Public Radio, Matt Sepik has more.
Judge Patrick Schiltz says ICE is not complying with his January 14th order to provide a bond hearing for a man in immigration detention or release him. Schiltz's order says ICE has failed to comply with dozens of similar orders. He says ICE Chief Todd Lyons must appear in court Friday to answer for why he shouldn't be held in contempt. Schiltz, a George W. Bush appointee, says, quote, the court's patience is at an end.
Matt Sepik prepared that report. The federal government faces a partial shutdown after Friday unless Congress passes a spending bill. Senate Democrats want to strip out funding for Homeland Security. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports this follows the killing of Minneapolis protester Alex Preddy.
The House passed a spending package on a bipartisan basis last week. It left for recess with the expectation the Senate would do the same. The bill needs to pass by Friday to avoid a shutdown of portions of the government. However, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the DHS funding plan is woefully inadequate and fails to keep ICE agents in check in the wake of Preddy's death. Democrats are demanding Republicans pull the DHS funding from the overall $1.3 trillion bill, which also funds the Departments of Defense, Labor, and Health and Human Services, among others. Republicans are pushing back, but many are also calling for a full investigation into Preddy's killing. Claudia DeSalis, NPR News.
Stocks open mixed this morning after some solid corporate earnings reports from Boeing and General Motors. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 400 points in early trading.
Boeing sales took off in the fourth quarter as the jetmaker recorded its best three-month period in 7 years. Boeing delivered almost three times as many commercial jets as it did in the same period a year ago. Boeing also turned a profit during the quarter, thanks in part to a one-time gain. General Motors also reported better-than-expected profits, although quarterly sales fell just short of forecast. GM announced a plan to buy back some $6 billion of its own stock. India and Europe have agreed to lower trade barriers as part of a massive trade deal covering 2 billion people and a quarter of global GDP. News of the deal comes after nearly two decades of negotiation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow is now down 420 points. This is NPR. Power is still out for more than 500,000 customers after the winter storm hit over the weekend. Most of the outages are in southern states. These got significant ice. It won't melt yet because forecasters say temperatures are going to be frigid for days. Then the National Weather Service says another blast of cold air will spread from the plains to the east this coming weekend. There's been a big upset in the women's competition at the Australian Open tennis tournament. American player and world number three Coco Gauff is out. Christina Kokuya reports from Melbourne.
Ukrainian Elena Svitolina was in control of the match from the start, taking just 59 minutes to defeat two-time Grand Slam champion Coco Gauff in straight sets, 6-2, 6-1 in the quarterfinals. Gauff struggled with her serve in a match played under a closed roof at Rod Laver Arena due to extreme heat conditions in Melbourne. Svitolina said she was happy to qualify for her first Australian Open semi-finals.
Yeah, very, very pleased with the tournament so far.
12th seed Svitolina will face Belarusian world number one Arina Sabalenka in the final four. Americans Iva Jovic and Lerna Tien were also eliminated in the quarterfinals on Tuesday. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukala in Melbourne.
Former FIFA president Sepp Blatter is calling for a boycott of men's World Cup soccer games that are played this summer in the U.S. Games will also be held in Canada and Mexico. Blatter suggests the Trump administration's actions show the U.S. is not a suitable host country. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Arm. On the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Renee Haas talks to Jayshree Ullal, host of cloud networking company Arista Networks, about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Governor Kathy Hochul says her push to cut auto insurance rates is about affordability and cracking down on fraud. But new reporting suggests powerful corporate interests may be playing a much bigger role behind the scenes. Joining us now is Kevin Duggan, reporter for Streets Blog NYC, who's been digging into the connections between big tech companies, political advocacy groups, and the governor's proposal. His recent reporting raises questions about who really benefits from these reforms and what they could mean for drivers across New York. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks, Tim. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
In your reporting for Streets Blog, you're writing that Uber and other big tech link groups are quietly shaping Governor Hochul's auto insurance proposal. Can you unpack what that is and what you mean by that for listeners who may not be completely familiar with the governor's proposal and what these groups are doing?
That's right. So we saw the governor had one of her big proposals for this year is to lower car insurance rates. As you mentioned, she's talking about going after fraud and regulations that she says allow for too big compensations for people involved in crashes. Now, we looked into, you know, whether there were any specific interest groups pushing this, and we saw that this group called Citizens for Affordable Rates had been spending a lot of money and hiring lobbyists to basically advance this push. And when we looked into this group, there were, you know, there is some information about them, but also other information was harder to find, like who is in charge or, you know, any address or something like that. But we found that this group is basically being led by Uber and has other, you know, car-focused companies and associations attached to it, like coach companies, trucking companies, and that they've been basically pushing pretty hard with both money and other lobbying in Albany for about a year or so to advance this policy.
Citizens for Affordable Rates or CAR sounds benign, but if right. It's being led by Uber, what are they looking for? What role are they playing in Albany?
Well, you know, a lot of the talking points they made are very similar to the proposals that Governor Hochul is pushing for, and that is basically to reduce the amount of compensation someone can get after a crash. And there are different kinds of compensation. We don't need to get into every detail, but basically the three top policy proposals that Hochul has put forward is to narrow the definition of who is seriously injured, which usually entitles you to extra compensation, not allow people who are found mostly at fault in a crash to get any damages for their pain and suffering, and also cap the damages for people who are uninsured or driving impaired or committing a felony at the time of the crash. Now, a lot of these sound like pretty straightforward, you know, changes in regulation, but when I've talked to attorneys who've represented victims of crashes, they basically warned that this could drastically cut back the amount of money you could recover if you were struck by a car, essentially.
So if you were struck by a car and these changes went through, advocates are arguing that that's going to matter for you. Is this push about cutting insurance costs for these big tech companies, or is it part of a broader strategy for tech and transportation companies to reshape liability and insurance markets?
Yeah, it's, you know, the end goal is still something we're looking into, but something that we've seen in my reporting is that there's been similar pushes around the country to basically lower the requirements for drivers, you know, in their insurance costs, such as in California. There was a similar push to basically lower damage thresholds that Uber was very supportive of as well. That came in exchange for allowing rideshare drivers to do collective bargaining. So there's been kind of pushes around the country. Florida also had a recent change in insurance that the governor here, Governor Hochul, often cites. So there seems to be a broader strategy of deregulating, you know, how much insurance drivers have to take out. And Uber has been backing at least some of these efforts we've seen.
Could you talk a little bit more about the victims' rights and the other crash victims or legal experts themselves, what they've said about these trade-offs in reduced compensation that are proposed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the cases, for instance, the regulation of getting rid of damages for anyone who's found slightly more than 50% at fault, you know, often in cases where someone sues for damages, a jury basically decides on a sliding scale how much you were at fault in the crash. And the damages that are awarded are adjusted to that, you know, how much you're found at fault. So if you're found, say, 60% at fault in a crash, you'll get 40% of the damages. Hochul would basically make it so that if you're found even slightly over half at fault, you'll get no damages at all. And that could be pretty drastic for someone who, you know, juries can be pretty subjective, and what they latch on to define as someone being at fault can be, you know, again, pretty subjective. Like a cyclist might not have been in the bike lane at the time or not wearing a helmet, even though that might not be against the law, they might count that towards somebody being at fault. And then you're kind of left out to dry depending on that verdict. So a lot of attorneys have raised concerns about that one in particular, because, you know, that could mean that there's a very high chance that the person who might have been a crash victim, if a jury finds to be slight more fault, they just get no payout whatsoever.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Kevin Duggan of Streets Blog NYC about new details in Governor Hochul's car insurance affordability pitch. It might shortchange crash victims, and it looks like big tech is behind this bid to make car insurance affordable, quote unquote. And what are folks saying, Kevin, in the, you know, safety advocate realm, small drivers, taxi workers, organized labor? How do they review this? How do they view this proposal?
Yeah, I spoke to the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. That's a group that represents taxi drivers and Uber and Lyft drivers in the city, focused on, you know, improving labor conditions for these drivers. They have not signed on to this push so far. The executive director of that group said she was somewhat skeptical of the push being led by Uber, and that basically they would oppose any policy change that would reduce coverage, because this would also affect their drivers. I mean, a driver in a crash would also have less rights to recover damages, you know. So it's a pretty broad policy that a lot of people who are focused on crash victims or even drivers rights in this case are skeptical of. And then, you know, the street safety advocates like Transportation Alternatives and groups like that are really saying that the governor should focus on improving street safety as opposed to chipping away at people's rights to recover damages. So they're urging her to sign a bill to crack down on repeated speeders in the state, which she has shown support for, and basically to focus more on making driving safer, which would cut down on crashes and in turn would cut down on insurance rates. So they really are trying to push that angle as opposed to, you know, reducing the amount of damages you can recover if you're in a crash.
And what is Governor Hochul saying?
She's saying, as you mentioned at the top, that this is really a push about affordability and that it's squeezing people out of the state, essentially, you know, using a lot of the same affordability rhetoric that we've heard from politicians all across the country right now, and that basically, you know, that this is just in the interests of New Yorkers. So she denies that this is being, you know, that this is a push being led by Uber.
And then also, so she's mentioning that there are some alleged scams, that it's the true affordability crisis. Yeah. What does she mean by that?
Yeah, she talked a lot about this at a press conference last week where she highlighted this proposal. She talked about, you know, fraud like staged crashes or medical fraud to inflate compensation for people. So she's basically saying that this is a big issue in driving up costs. It's unclear, you know, how much this plays into what rates insurance companies set. And it's also unclear whether any of these reforms she's proposed would dramatically reduce the costs. The only thing we do know is that it will reduce the amount of compensation you could get in a crash.
And when you reached out to Governor Hochul's office for some comment on this, what response did you get? It surprised me, I think, that this may have been repetitive information from the big tech group.
Yeah. I mean, when she first announced this policy in her State of the State address, we reached out coming to her with some concerns from crash victims, even though we didn't know all the details yet. And, her press office basically forwarded us a press release by the group CAR, Citizens for Affordable Rates, which had been sent to them by an Uber spokesperson. So that kind of raised alarm bells for us as to, like, you know, the connection in her State of the State and the this group pushing this agenda.
And as you're right, Uber's not looking out for victims, but its own cost, its own bottom line.
Yes, that's something that, Albany Watchdogs talked to us about as well. This group Reinvent Albany talked to their executive director, and he basically said that, a push like that being forwarded by Uber should be, taken with a large grain of salt, given that in the past they have looked out for their own interests first. So, the kind of rhetoric of affordability and bringing down costs should be questioned, basically, is what they suggested.
What do you think lawmakers should be asking about the substance of these reforms and the influence of outside groups?
Yeah, I think, lawmakers should be looking into the claims that this will lower insurance. Like, we should really have clear data showing that this would work, and also just, question the governor about any kind of conversations he's had with Uber and groups like CAR over this in recent times.
And what about listeners who are trying to sift through all this? What should they be looking for?
I think over the next coming weeks, we'll see a lot of discussion around policies coming up in the state budget in March. So there are things that kind of, there'll be a lot of discussions between lawmakers and the governor about this. So, it's just worth keeping an eye out in the next coming weeks and maybe 2 months about like how this proposal will evolve. A lot of these things happen in the 11th hour in Albany. So, we might not know until the budget is published, like what actually is going to happen.
That's Kevin Duggan from Streets Blog NYC talking about big tech secretly behind Governor Hochul's auto insurance rate cut push. You can read more about all of that reporting from Kevin at nyc.streetsblog.org. Kevin, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Now, as national attention remains fixed on ICE operations in Minneapolis, in New York, in Putnam County, some residents are defending a local school board member employed by ICE. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Lower Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Elias Guerra reports.
The Mayopac Falls Elementary School auditorium was filled with local residents Thursday for the Board of Education meeting. Some were there to call for the removal of one school board trustee, Chris Harrigan, who also works for ICE, specifically enforcement and removal operations. But most of those turned out defended Harrigan. As the Trump administration's aggressive crackdown on immigration continues across the country, local resident Marie Frankel said she thinks the Democratic Party is behind community pushback on Harrigan's employment with ICE.
Your behavior is appalling, placing images of him on a website saying ICE is evil. It's a threat to our board member and his family. These images should be removed. Perhaps we should place your photos on a website showing your support for illegal aliens over citizens.
While a majority of those who spoke are in support of Harrigan, others want him removed from the school board. Ixmucane Pereira, a Carmel resident, first addressed the board in Spanish.
Uno de sus miembros de la mesa directiva delante de mí se llevó gente, se llevó padres, se llevó...
Pereira said she's opposed to a school board member having access to students' personal information. She tells WAMC she once saw Harrigan with ICE over the summer.
In August, middle of August, a mom called me and she said, there is ICE outside, there is a lot of strange people outside. So I ran and they were looking for someone, a young man. They were like 17 people. They were like 11 cars surrounding two workers. That was my first encounter with Chris Harrigan.
And you recognized him?
Definitely, every time. And many parents told me he is the man who's in charge of the crew in Putnam County.
Photos and videos on Facebook show Harrigan in an ICE enforcement and removal operation vest. One video appears to show Harrigan detaining a man outside of the Brewster police station. Pereira said she is looking for the son of a man detained by ICE.
Felipe was taken on Sunday morning, and then his son is young and just arrived in a refugee program. And Felipe was the only other person that he knew, and that man took him away, and now we don't know where this young man disappeared to. I need you to help me to find him. I need you to help me to find both of them.
The residents who defended Harrigan did not deny he worked for ICE. Instead, they said it was no one else's business what a man did for work. That's what local resident Kate Bellatoni told the school board.
The trustee has a job. He has a boss. He pays the same high taxes we all do. He needs to support his family. Therefore, he needs to work. I am proud to stand by this trustee, and I know a majority of Mayapak is too.
School board member Tanner McCracken also spoke in support of Harrigan. He said he thinks his colleague is doing good work and that the residents of Mayapak support him.
He's a good man, and what he does for his job is to keep our community safe. We've gotten coffee through the years, we've talked. What he does, a lot of folks wouldn't do that type of work, but he does it to keep us safe. So they were in huge support. Obviously, there were people here protesting him, asking him to resign. I have gone public and said that I believe that is ridiculous to ask a board member to resign their position because of their job occupation.
The board stated they did not plan to remove Harrigan. As Harrigan left the meeting, he said he will not step down.
Do you have 2 minutes to talk?
I gotta run everything through headquarters.
Okay.
If I say anything.
Okay. You're not.
I'm not resigning.
No, I know.
Yeah, so that's all I would say.
Okay.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
And coming up, the largest broadband investment in U.S. history was supposed to move fast. So why is Pennsylvania still waiting months after submitting its plan? And how could new federal rules change who gets connected? We'll get the details next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. What does recovery look like a year after the devastating fires in Los Angeles? Who gets to rebuild? Who leaves? That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, 911 calls about ICE agents from around the country.
I've got two vehicles that are in Border Patrol and they're following me, and I'm a U.S. citizen, and there's actually four of them trying to ram into my car. Can you please send someone ASAP?
They're calls from emergency rooms, business owners, and immigration agents themselves.
I'm a Border Patrol agent. They stole my uniform.
That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Hundreds of millions of federal dollars meant to expand high-speed internet access in Pennsylvania are still stuck in limbo. The state submitted its broadband spending plan more than 4 months ago, but federal officials have yet to approve it, well past their own deadline. The delay has stalled construction project and left unanswered questions about how and when that money will reach communities that still lack reliable internet. Charlotte Keith covers state government and infrastructure for Spotlight PA, and she's been reporting on what's holding things up.
This is all to do with this big pot of federal broadband funding. And in Pennsylvania right now, things are kind of on hold because the state submitted its spending plan to the federal government in early September, and it's still waiting for that to be approved. Until that happens, you know, things can't really get underway. The contracts can't be finalized with the companies who will actually be doing this work. They can't begin construction. There's also actually another layer of federal approval that Pennsylvania will need to get, aside from the one that we discussed in this story. And this delay is really notable because the Trump administration has really emphasized that they want to move very quickly on getting this broadband funding out. And the federal agency in charge of reviewing these plans pledged to get that done within 90 days of states submitting them. But in Pennsylvania's case, that hasn't happened yet. It's been more than 120 days now, and the state is still waiting.
They missed that 90-day review deadline by weeks. What explanation, if any, have they offered to Pennsylvania or other states that are still waiting?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting, you know, most states have been approved by this point. Pennsylvania is one of about 10 states that are still waiting, and some of those, they had their own issues. They had to get extensions. But the cause of the delay for Pennsylvania is kind of unclear. You know, there have been reports about the federal agency that's looking at these plans, kind of going back and asking states to change very specific things to bring costs down. We don't know if that's been happening to Pennsylvania. I mean, the other thing is just that it is a very ambitious deadline. And it's worth noting that this 90 days we're talking about, it's not, you know, from federal law. It's really just self-imposed by the Trump administration kind of to signal their commitment to getting this done fast.
Let's talk about the impact on the ground. What does this holdup mean right now for Pennsylvania communities that still don't have reliable high-speed internet?
Yeah, well, it's probably only, you know, a temporary holdup, but it's coming on top of what has already been quite a tumultuous time for this broadband funding. The Trump administration over the summer asked states to redo their spending plans and grant applications on a very tight 90-day deadline. And after that happened, you know, state officials joked that calling that work a sprint would be a kind way to describe it. So this all goes back to 2021 when Congress passed this bipartisan infrastructure bill to approve all this funding. And it's been sort of a long process to get to this point. Trump administration officials have been very critical of the pace of progress under the Biden administration. And so that's part of why, you know, they're saying things really need to move fast. But for now in Pennsylvania, it's been a bit, you know, kind of hurry up and wait.
President Trump and his administration rewrote the rules for this program after he took office. What were some of the significant changes and how did they reshape Pennsylvania's broadband plan?
Yeah, so one of the big focuses was to bring the costs down. So Pennsylvania will actually not end up spending its full original $1.1 billion allocation. It will be spending about $790 million. And that's for a number of reasons, but partly because the rules emphasize spending less on fiber optic broadband and more on technologies like satellite and wireless internet. And so Pennsylvania has, you know, both of those in its plan. It's still going to be spending most of the money on fiber broadband. But the rules did kind of open the door for those technologies to be included more.
We're in a rural area here. It seems as if fiber might be more reliable than a shift to satellite and wireless internet connection. Is that a controversial thing, especially in rural areas, for rural areas?
That's actually one of the main objections that experts raised when the rule changes were coming down. That, you know, satellite and wireless, the upfront cost to install them is lower generally than fiber, which can be very expensive. But they're kind of less of a long-term investment. So experts told us that, okay, yes, those technologies, they can meet the minimum speed requirements for this program, but are they going to be the technologies that we're able to rely on for the speeds we need, you know, 10 years from now?
Your reporting indicates that Pennsylvania will expect to spend far less than its full $1.1 billion allocation. Why is that, and what happens with any unused money?
So it's partly because of the rule changes. It's partly because basically more areas now have broadband than they did when the infrastructure law was first passed. So fewer places need this money. What happens to the leftover money is still kind of up in the air. At the end of last year, the president signed this executive order tying the state of that funding to a review of state laws on artificial intelligence. And so it seems that if there are states whose regulations on AI are deemed overly burdensome, they could lose that money. It's really not clear yet what that will look like or what that could mean for Pennsylvania. But obviously, there's a lot of money at stake there. And the state would probably much rather have that to be able to use for other broadband purposes.
Yes, and NTIA has warned that it could reject grants it considers, quote, excessive. That creates so much uncertainty for states trying to plan long-term infrastructure projects, and it seems as if Pennsylvania's been trying to plan broadband access for a long time. Meanwhile, people are still waiting. Do you think that there's a realistic timeline that this is going to happen sooner rather than later?
I mean, it's certainly one of those things that is a really big disconnect between, you know, what it feels like for people who are waiting for this, who, you know, need this in their day-to-day lives, and what's actually quite a complex administrative task to figure out which are the areas that should get this and how to make that happen the best way. Certainly, once Pennsylvania's plan is approved, that is a huge step forward. And, you know, that will mean that then a lot of more specific things can start to be done. And once the grants go out, the companies have, you know, a time frame of several years when they have to commit to providing that service by. So definitely this plan that is still waiting to be approved, you know, that would be a really big step forward.
That's Charlotte Keith, investigative reporter for Spotlight PA. You can read her reporting about broadband expansion on hold in Pennsylvania as feds miss their self-imposed deadline. That's at spotlightpa.org. Charlotte, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Hawley is still in the planning phase, but the ideas on the table could reshape the borough for years to come. More on what's being discussed and what's next. Next, this is Radio Chatskill.
NPR Music is looking for the next great undiscovered musician to play the tiny desk. If you're an unsigned artist, record a video of yourself playing one original song behind a desk and submit it to the 11th annual Tiny Desk Contest by February 9th. And if you win, you'll play your very own Tiny Desk concert. Think you've got what it takes? Learn more at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville, and at vintagehousejville.com, and from listeners like you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Hawley is taking a close look at how access to the outdoors can shape its future. The borough is in the middle of an outdoor towns planning process, an effort to boost the local economy by improving public access to natural resources like rivers, trails, and open space. It's part of a broader movement across Northeast Pennsylvania where communities are investing in outdoor infrastructure, not just for recreation, but as a strategy for long-term economic revitalization. The River reporter Liam Mayo joins us now to explain what Hawley is planning. Liam, hello.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
For listeners who don't know about this, what is the Outdoor Towns Initiative, and what's Hawley hoping to achieve through this process?
So the Outdoor Towns Initiative goes back to this Outdoor Towns Toolkit, which was a sort of self-help toolkit created by the nonprofit PA Environmental Council, which would have helped towns sort of work through the process of figuring out ways to better use their outdoor spaces and revitalize their natural economies. More recently, this company or this consulting team, Eastwick Solutions, was selected by the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources to launch a pilot program where they would help towns work through this toolkit and become outdoor towns. So there were initial pilots in Forest City and Carbondale. Now Hawley is sort of midway through the process, and Honesdale as well is on the horizon for working with this initiative. And the simple goal of it is to come up with a plan that has a ton of input from the community about what steps the municipality could take, or people associated with the municipality could take, to improve the utilization of outdoor spaces in the borough. Some of the items that kind of have emerged as a short list for ideas that could make it into the plan include some, I guess, like typical outdoors improvements, like supporting a Wayne County trail from Holly to White Mills, or clarifying trail names and color coding the trails, revising the trail map so it's easier for people to access the trails in Holly, finding funding for the design of a pedestrian bridge along the Lackawaxen. But it also ropes in other things that are kind of essential for, you know, enjoying and using the outdoors, but aren't as strictly about like accessing natural spaces. For instance, enhancing the community's like calendar of events so there's more to do when people visit the town, and encouraging outdoors dining with local businesses. So it encompasses kind of a wide spectrum of things.
How does this process work for outdoor towns? Who's involved, and how does a town move from ideas like this that are on the table to an actual plan?
Yeah, so the way it was explained to work in Holly, I'm assuming it works similar in the other towns as well, or I believe it works similar in other towns as well, I just don't know as much about how it works in the other towns, is Eastwick Solutions sort of comes in, they put together this action team of members of the local community, and it works sort of with regular meetings with that action team, as well as sort of more open to the broader public meetings. They've been working for the better part of a year to gather ideas from the Holly community. This sort of kicked off with a community input meeting back last May of 2025. There was a public survey that went around. There was a walk shop, like a walking workshop, where people just walked around Holly looking at the things that could potentially make it into part of the plan. That initial outreach ended up with a long list of around 65 ideas that the action team sort of thought were actionable. Well, the action team ended up narrowing that list down to around 30 ideas. And last Tuesday, January 20, there was another open meeting to the public where public members narrowed that list down to sort of their top priorities, or they ranked what their top priorities were out of that list of 30. And then the consultants and the action team are going to get back together, choose 15 to 20 for inclusion in that final plan, and then put that plan back out for review by the public and Holly Borough.
From that 15 or 20 things on the list, are residents and local leaders saying certain ones they want to see more than others, or are they saying they want to see certain things improved or expanded when it comes to public access to nature?
Yeah, there were a couple of things that really stood out as priorities. I think the priorities that people really ranked highly were about creating more things that help people access the nature, like constructing sidewalks, constructing a pedestrian bridge, constructing a trail. The consultant said like the plan has around a 3 to 5 year time frame. But it also said that like some of those ideas won't necessarily get completed within that time frame. Like they said, there's a lot of those ideas about creating new points of public access are going to be harder and take a lot more time to put into play. Whereas some of the other ideas, like the idea they used as an example was adding Holly's Trails to the All Trails app. Like that's something that could be done very easily, and that could be a thing that makes it into the plan. Whereas the construction of a pedestrian bridge over the Lackawaxen River, that could also make it into the plan, but the like actionable part of that within the immediate like future wouldn't necessarily be the construction of that bridge. It would be finding funding for the design of the bridge, just because the full construction of that is going to be difficult and is going to take a significant amount of time. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of ideas in that plan. Some of them are more easily actionable than others, but I think a lot of the priorities from the public centered around some of those broader ones that really would help improve public access to nature in Holly.
This approach is certainly different from traditional economic development strategies we usually hear about in small towns. What kinds of economic benefits are people hoping this could bring to the borough?
Yeah, the pitch of sort of outdoors towns as like this specific planning process, because, you know, there are a lot of different ways for communities to look at and catalog their natural resources. But one of the pitches of this one is natural development as economic development. Kim Stevard said that they're, or who was one of the consultants with Eastwick Solutions, said that they specialize in, quote, creating plans to help communities leverage their nature-based assets like rivers and trails and lakes to help build an economy around that. And she said that, you know, this works in large part through growing a tourism economy, pitching Hawley as a place for people to come. They'll, you know, use the trails, use the river, use the lakes, and then while they're in town, they'll shop at some of the local businesses. They'll grab a coffee. They'll pick up a trinket at the antique store. And Hawley, they'll grow Hawley's economy sort of through that. And the process of building a natural economy, that will have sort of side benefits for residents of Hawley. Like, the trails and everything are going to be a benefit to the people who live in Hawley, but the way this specific planning process works, the focus is more on how these things could be used to grow the natural economy, rather than sort of focusing primarily or solely on what benefit could this have to local residents.
When we spoke last week, we talked about the Restore the Star initiative in Milford, the People's Playground project in Honesdale. And while these aren't officially part of the Outdoor Towns initiative, they are part of this broader sense of folks in Northeast Pennsylvania focusing on these outdoor initiatives and these outdoor things that would attract people into their towns. Why do you think it's resonating right now in Northeast PA specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that is coming out is that the fact that outdoor spaces and natural spaces can build an economy is something that's being supported and being pushed a little bit. The Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources has been emphasizing, sort of in its messaging and in the grants that it is giving out, and it's supporting this Outdoors Town project through grant funding as well. It's supporting the idea that, you know, the natural world isn't just something to be preserved or something to be enjoyed. It is part of the economic world as well. Some figures that they put out for 2023 showed that outdoors recreation contributed $19 billion to the state's overall economy, accounting for 2% of Pennsylvania's gross domestic product. And the consultants with Eastwick Solutions were kind of comparing that to other industries that are sort of more commonly talked about when you talk about economic development, like fracking or warehousing, some things that, are seen as, you know, the Pennsylvania's economic future, but also things that have potentially deleterious economic, effects or environmental effects. So, I think one of the things that's happening is this pushback and this support for the idea that, well, it doesn't have to be a trade-off when you're considering economic growth and environmental preservation. You can preserve the environment and you can support people's access to the environment in a way that helps your economy and that isn't sort of just shutting the door on economic development. So I think that's one of the things that is helping stuff like this and stuff like the Lackawaxen River Trails Initiative spread across northeastern Pennsylvania right now, in addition to kind of all of the things we talked about last week in terms of the spirit of community and the spirit of people realizing that people need to step up and build the world that they want to see and they want to live in.
And they're looking for folks to, you know, get more info, participate in the project, or even volunteer. Where can folks do that who have an interest in what's going on there in Hawley?
Yeah, folks can contact info@visithawleypa.com for more information. And yeah, I think one of the things that the whole plan involves is people stepping up to do different things. I don't think this is the kind of thing where you know, the plan is in place, and then it is going to be like one government body's or one official's like individual responsibility to see it through. I think it is going to be a broader thing where this is outlining steps the community as a whole can take to push things forward. So it is going to kind of take everybody.
It takes a village, as they say. That's Liam Mayo. That's Liam Mayo of the River Reporter. You could read his article on the outdoor spaces and economic revitalization in Hawley at riverreporter.com, as well as all the great reporting from the team there. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll learn more about a daytime party. If you want to dance, feel the beat, but still get home for dinner, daytime disco makes it possible. Coming up, we'll learn more about this unique daytime dance party. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry.
The FDA regulates 20% of the U.S. economy, and there are so many things broken at the FDA.
And how does McCarry plan to fix what's broken?
We're going to find out what sounds promising and bring that to the forefront.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
You are listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Imagine a disco party, but in the middle of the day, without alcohol and with a soundtrack curated by one of our region's top electronic music DJs. That's Daytime Disco, a new immersive dance experience hosted by Mark Partridge, also known as Ambient Barn. You know Ambient Barn airs here on Radio Catskill tonight at 9. Mark joining us today to talk about why he created this upbeat, sober daytime party and what kind of musical you'll hear. Hey, welcome.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thank you. You know, we know you locally as Ambient Barn. Can you tell listeners what daytime disco is and what inspired you to create it?
Yeah. I think based on everything that we've experienced over the last 2 days with this sort of incredible snowstorm, I think something like this is, you know, sort of more necessary than ever. I mean, you know, there are so many people in this region who are creative and love to dance. And sometimes it's difficult to get out at night. You know, I think there's a lot of people that I talk to that want to come out and dance. They want to shake off the winter blues. They want to warm up. They want to be in a communal space. And it's hard for people to get out at night. We have a lot of amazing nighttime disco dance parties or DJ dance parties in this area. And I thought that there was some space to do something during the day. You know, I was inspired by the Mr. Sunday parties back in Brooklyn that used to happen back in the, you know, 10, 15 years ago. They were sort of these daytime dance parties, all ages, super inspiring, super uplifting, no judgment, no like, you know, nightlife, cool guy energy, just like open, fun communal space. And I thought that it would be really cool to bring that to the Catskills.
You know, there was a time back in the day where I could go out at night, but now 8:30 comes and wow.
yeah, exactly.
So this isn't, right. You're not your typical nightclub. It's a sober daytime dance party. Why is that important as well?
Well, so we kind of came up with this idea for, we call them hydration bars. So we're sort of working out the kinks. This is our first one. We plan on doing a series of pop-ups all throughout the year. In different towns and different spaces. That's sort of part of the concept, is sort of bringing dancers to interesting spaces sort of around the region. You know, again, wintertime, like people shouldn't be drinking and driving, you know, I know, so we're trying to fill that space a little bit. You know, we're thinking about partnering with some mocktail companies in the future, doing different kinds of non-alcoholic beverages with adaptogens and things like that, things that really sort of take the idea of nightclubbing and dancing and kind of just like bring it out into the daylight a little bit. You know, like you can come and dance all afternoon, drive home, you feel uplifted, you have dinner, you watch a movie, and you go to bed. You know, it doesn't have to be the other way around, where you have a full day, then you get in your car, and you go out to the bar, the club, and you drink, and you dance, and then you come home. Not that there's anything wrong with that. No judgment. Like, yeah. I love nightlife. I love dancing at night, but it just felt like something interesting and new to try out. And the DVAA has been great, and you guys have been super supportive as well. And we're just super excited to launch this first one.
You know, we talk about dance music, electronic music, and clubs. You think of like a, you know, sort of a heavy vibe. What kind of music can people expect during the day? And how do you approach a daytime set differently than you might approach on your show or in an evening club set?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that as a performer and a musician, my work tends to be super eclectic. You know, I don't sort of lock into one genre all the time. I like to hop around, you know, I like to create different moods and different vibes with different genres of music. And sort of the challenge of blending different genres, is something that as an artist, I really enjoy. So for something like this, you know, I think we start with daytime vibes. You know, I just think like uplifting, major key, forward progress, things that will delight, you know, and create sort of a sense of wonder in the daylight. You know, the set is definitely not super moody, where sometimes my nighttime sets can be kind of moody and a little bit kind of on the dark side. So this is just lighter. You know, we have some Italo disco. We're doing some house music, some pop bangers. I'm doing some like sort of custom edits, of some like, you know, super famous, well-known songs. And we're just going to throw it in and make like a big, like beautiful stew of dance music that hopefully a lot of people, will connect with.
I think this was just announced fairly recently. Have you gotten good response? What have people been saying about this idea? And, you know, do you think it's got some legs, I guess? You'll see more of these.
I think we do. I think we've been talking about this for a couple of months, you know, and the response has been incredible. I think people really are going to come out of the woodwork for this. I think that activating interesting spaces around the county is something that I really, really want to do. You know, bringing dance to different places and different people and sort of creating a space, a daytime disco space out of the community of dancers that are sort of spread out in the mountains here. So, yeah, I think this is going to pop off. I think Saturday is going to be great. I think people are going to be tired of the cold. You know, it's going to be 2 hours. It's from 1 to 3 at the DVAA in Narrowsburg. It's the first one. And we're going to hopefully do these once or twice a month, for the rest of 2026. And the response has been great. I think there's a lot of white space to fill here, and we're excited to kind of start filling that white space up.
What do you hope, folks take away after dancing at the daytime disco this Saturday?
You know, I hope that, people understand that what we're trying to do is to create a communal, non-judgmental space to come express yourself, dance as you want. We want people to kind of feel alive, to move their body. You know, movement is meditation, especially now in the doldrums of winter. Everybody's got the winter blues. Like, come out, see some people, dance. You know, one of the things that we keep telling everybody is rummage through your closet, find that outfit that you have nowhere else to wear it to and put it on and come out and just be yourself and dance and enjoy and talk to some folks. We're going to have live visuals too. It's just going to be a really good, it's going to be a great party, I think.
Yeah, that's Daytime Disco coming up this Saturday, the 31st from 1 to 3 at Kraus Recital Hall in Narrowsburg. It's part of the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance Salon Series. And there's more information at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. We'll also have some information up on our website. And don't forget Ambient Barn tonight at 9, right?
That is correct, tonight at 9.
All right, that's Mark Partridge, a.k.a. Ambient Bard. We're going to go out with a little bit of ambient music from, I think, one of your shows here. Thanks so much, and looking forward to it.
Thanks, Tim. Have a good one.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Reminder, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It hits your inbox every Friday. Go to wjffradio.org. Stay involved and informed with what's going on in the area for free. wjffradio.org, our free weekly newsletter. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Chatskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
With dangerously cold temperatures in the forecast, warming centers are open across our region to provide a safe, heated place for anyone who needs it. Locations are available in Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange counties, as well as Pike County in Pennsylvania. If you or someone you know needs a warm place to go, you can find a full list of locations and hours at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the new exotic sounds of the Tiger Club, vibraphonist Mark Riddle, and the Martini Kings. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join us where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Bitter cold continues. There may be some intermittent snow and flurries this afternoon. Could accumulate a coating to an inch. High of only 13. Cold low tonight, zero. It'll stay cold all week. Tomorrow, high of 18. Maybe some periods of sun too. Tomorrow night's low, minus 8. Thursday, 13. And the cold continues through the weekend, maybe warming up on Monday. But we're also keeping an eye on a potential coastal storm this weekend. Nothing to report just yet, but it's kind of showing up on a couple of folks' long-range forecasts. Stay with Radio Catskill for the latest updates.
Okay, this is weird.
A scientific fluke.
Had you ever seen anything like that before?
No.
That started growing brain matter in a Petri dish.
Scientists just put pieces of human and mice brain on a plate and wired it to a computer.
It's effectively a biocomputer.
Like humanoid, organoid, very sci-fi.
We've created a new category of thing that is maybe alive.
Brain balls.
It is alive.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. What does recovery look like a year after the devastating fires in Los Angeles? Who gets to rebuild? Who leaves? That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you.
Hey, this is Matt Hurtado. Join me for Virtual Soundscapes, your gateway to the best music in gaming. Classic tracks from the 8-bit era, modern releases, and interviews with the minds behind the games. Wednesday night at 9 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.